It's time to tell our side of the story, but we need your help. Please share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider becoming a Backstage subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll have access to our entire back catalog of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast. Just visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away.
It's hard to do anything these days without hearing about the Black Lives Matter movement. Turn on the news, watch sports, read your kids' homework, or just innocently grab a bite to eat. And chances are, you're going to get a healthy dose of their ideology.
Are you a Christian?
Put your fist up. Here are the protesters shutting down the restaurants in Rochester, New York over the weekend.
The Black Lives Matter movement is everywhere. Where did it come from? And perhaps more importantly, what does it want? I'm Patrick Carolci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show. This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks.
Stories about everyday Americans that the elites ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth. Welcome to Red Pilled America. Have you been asking yourself the question, why lately? Why is this country seemingly plunging into chaos? Here's why. The left controls every cultural institution in America. Academia, film, literature, music, art, basically all forms of storytelling. They've been pumping a Marxist ideology into the American bloodstream for decades. Red Pilled America remains the only storytelling show of its kind that acts as an antidote to this poison. But we need your support to keep this show going. Please help us fight the good fight. We have several ways you can support the show. You can buy one of our 100% Made in America products. We have hats, candles, a book, and aprons. You can also become a Backstage subscriber where you get access to our entire archive of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast about each show. Or you can just make a donation. Please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. Black Lives Matter is everywhere. It's in the news, saturating sports, painted on the streets, and littering your kids' school curriculum. Fire up Netflix and you may get a list of recommended BLM-aligned movies. Go to Starbucks and be treated to a Black Lives Matter ad on employee t-shirts. Buy something from Amazon and you might see a BLM-inspired banner hit your screen. Send your kids off to college and expect them to return with the idea of white privilege occupying their minds like a tumor. Or drive into any major city and you'll grab a glimpse of their handiwork, boarded up storefronts, care of a recent BLM riot. Black Lives Matter aligned organizations have even strong-armed private schools to include mandatory courses in anti-racism and white privilege, ensuring America's future leaders are fully indoctrinated in the ideology of their movement. This all just seemed to come from out of nowhere. Where did the Black Lives Matter movement come from? And more importantly, what does it want? To find the answer, we're going to take a deep dive into the BLM movement that has saturated our TV screens, social media feeds, educational system, and streets. On its face, the phrase Black Lives Matter is indisputable, but hidden in the mantra is a goal that most either don't realize or are afraid to admit. And the best way to begin understanding the movement is to first grasp how it initially gained national prominence.
It was a brief encounter in the summer of 2014 that brought all of the pieces together.
St. Louis County police have taken over the investigation of a shooting by a Ferguson police officer that left a teenager dead. It happened at the Canfield Green apartment complex in Ferguson. Angry crowds gathered after the shooting and extra police were called in.
The 18-year-old that was shot and killed by a Ferguson, Missouri police officer was named Michael Brown. He was unarmed. By the time the media arrived within minutes of the shooting, the body of the 6'5", nearly 300-pound black man was still on the street, covered in a white sheet, and his mother was inconsolable on the sidewalk.
You took my son away from me. You know how hard it was for me to get him to stay in school and graduate? You know how many black men graduate? Not many, because you bring them down to this type of level where they feel like I don't got nothing to live for anyway.
A friend that was with Michael during the shooting, 22-year-old Dorian Johnson, explained to the gathering media what happened.
Me and my friend, we was walking down the street in the middle of the street, and we wasn't causing any harm to nobody. We had no weapons on us at all. We just walking, having a conversation. No cars were blowing at us or honking at us like we was holding up traffic or anything like that. A police officer squad car pulled up. And when he pulled up, these were his exact words. He said, "Get the F on the sidewalk." And we told the officer we was not but a minute away from our destination, and we was shortly be out the street. We was having a conversation, and he went about his way for about 1 or 2 seconds as we continued to walk. And then he reversed his truck, his car, and in a manner to where it almost hit us, and it blocked both lanes off the way he turned his car. So he pulled up on the side of us. He tried to thrust his door open, but we were so close to it that it ricocheted off us and it bounced back to him. And I guess that, you know, got him a little upset. And at that time, he reached out the window. He didn't get out the car. He just reached his arm out the window and grabbed my friend around his neck and was trying to, as he was trying to choke my friend. And he was trying to get away, and the officer then reached out and he grabbed his arm to pull him into the car. So now it's like the officer's pulling him inside the car and he's trying to pull away. And at no time the officer said that he was going to do anything until he pulled out his weapon. His weapon was drawn and he said, "I'll shoot you," or "I'm going to shoot." And in the same moment, the first shot went off. And we looked at him, he was shot and it was blood coming from him. And we took off running. And as we took off running, I ducked and hid for my life because I was feared for my life. And I hid by the first car that I saw. My friend, he kept running. And he told me to keep running because he feared for me too. So as he was running, the officer was trying to get out of the car. And once he got out the car, he pursued my friend, but his weapon was drawn. Now, he didn't see any weapon drawn at him or anything like that, us going for no weapon. His weapon was already drawn when he got out the car. He shot again, and once my friend felt that shot, he turned around and he put his hands in the air and he started to get down, but the officer still approached with his weapon drawn and he fired several more shots.
According to Dorian, the officer didn't say anything to his friend Michael. He just murdered him like an animal. When the shooting ended, Dorian took off.
By then, I was so afraid for my life, I got up and I ran. I ran as fast as I could back home to my daughter and my woman, because I didn't know what was going on. We wasn't committing any crime, bringing no harm to nobody, but my friend was murdered in cold blood.
The story Dorian painted was horrific. It was an unprovoked execution, an act only a monster could commit. A young black man was just walking in the streets, minding his own business, and was shot for nothing. And the story Dorian told seemed to be backed by another on the scene, a woman named Pigette Crenshaw.
He was unarmed. He ran for his life. They shot him, and he fell. He put his arms up to let them know he was compliant and that he was unarmed, and they shot him twice more, and he fell to the ground and died. They killed this boy for no reason, and there should be justice about this.
According to her, Michael Brown put his hands up in the universal sign of surrender, and he was gunned down anyways. By the close of the night, local media had a racially charged cop killing that they knew would resonate nationally, and they ran with it.
It was an emotional and tense day in Ferguson after a Ferguson police officer shot and killed a 17-year-old who witnesses say was not carrying a weapon. It happened just after noon on Canfield Drive in the midst of the Canfield Green apartment complex.
An angry crowd quickly gathered protesting the shooting. Witnesses say 7 to 8 shots were fired.
Everybody is extremely mad at this. This is another Trayvon Martin story. A young man died before his time because of brutality from a different race. It's racial profiling.
Now, friends of the teenager who died today tell me that he graduated from high school this spring and that he would not be considered an aggressive person.
By the following day, national media amplified the story.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. But there are conflicting reports about what led up to the shooting.
On the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, outrage and anger.
No justice! No peace!
Protesters of different ages and races demanding answers in the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown at the hands of a policeman. Investigators said at about noon Saturday, the officer, who hasn't been identified, encountered Brown and another man on the street in an apartment complex. There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police shot this man for no reason.
Piaget Crenshaw, who took the cell phone video, says she saw those shots from her apartment balcony.
He's running this way. He turns his body towards this way, hands in the air, being compliant. He gets shot in his face and chest and goes down and dies.
Michael Brown graduated from high school earlier this spring and was to begin college next week. His mother, Leslie McSpadden, has a message for the officer who killed him.
You're not God. You don't decide when you're going to take somebody from her. If that was the case, I brought him here. I should have took him from her. That was mine. That belonged to me.
The story seemed perfectly designed for mass media consumption. An unarmed young black man, someone who was not aggressive, with all of the hope in the world ahead of him, was racially profiled and executed after surrendering. A story of this nature in a newsroom is like feeding chum to hungry sharks, and Michael Brown's family, friends, and supporters seemed to know the touch points to make it go viral.
He was a big guy in stature, but when he opened his mouth, he had a very, very quiet, soft-spoken voice.
He was a gentle giant. He was big. He cared for everybody. He was loving.
He really was a gentle giant.
He was nothing but a gentle giant.
To become violent in Michael Brown's name is to betray the gentle giant that he was.
The gentle giant wouldn't hurt a fly. The circumstances were just too much for the citizens of Ferguson to swallow. They took to the streets almost immediately. Protests started off, as the media would say, peacefully.
The night began with this peaceful vigil for Michael Brown.
But peaceful devolved to the now familiar sign of community grieving. Fergusonians began looting.
We need justice now!
The night of violence was in stark contrast to the peaceful demonstrations earlier in the day, sparked by the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on Saturday.
Tonight, there is a lot of looting going on, and now we are at yet another location that is being looted as we speak.
Well, I had a quick trip with NZN started, and looting.
Yeah, I was just at the sporting goods store, and then looked behind me, and the shopping center, there's at least three more stores being looted at this point.
I'll give you some of that money. Oh, that rest of the now the rest of them.
Looting the ransack.
Get it.
We're seeing a lot of windows being smashed, people running out with clothing. I have noticed that a lot of these vehicles that are involved in this, a lot of the tags have been removed from those cars as these looters continue to go through these stores and carry out everything they can carry. No police presence in this area. They were just here just a few moments ago and left and went to another area.
Overnight, on fire and out of control.
It's a free-for-all here.
North of St. Louis, thieves ruled the night, ransacking local businesses.
No justice! No peace!
Police armed with riot gear couldn't keep up. Watch as people of all ages loot this convenience store and then burn it down.
Don't blow up.
At this sporting goods shop, it was a free-for-all, barely interrupted by sirens, an entirely different scene from the emotional protest for the slain young man.
Here at the spot where Michael Brown was killed, hundreds still gathering, with calls for an even bigger rally tomorrow at the police station.
And they got what they asked for, with angry crowds adopting the mantra, "Hands up, don't shoot," to protest police brutality against the black community.
Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot!
As the looting and burning raged in Ferguson, eyewitnesses that claimed to see Michael Brown put his hands up in surrender began to pop up more and more on cable news, including Michael Brown's friend, Dorian Johnson.
And I'm looking, I'm watching the officer, he's pursuing my friend now that he fired another shot. It struck my friend in the back. Then my friend stopped running, his hands immediately went in the air and he turned around towards the officer face to face. He started to tell the officer that he was unarmed and that you should stop shooting me. Before he can get his second sentence out, the officer fired several more shots into his head and chest areas.
Okay, what I saw was when the cop and Michael were like wrestling through the window. It looked as if Michael was pushing off and the cop was trying to pull him in. Then the cop shot a fire through the window. Michael breaks away and he starts running away from the officer. The officer gets out of his vehicle and pursues Michael as he's shooting his weapon. Michael jerks his body as if he was hit, then he turns around, faces the officer, and puts his hands up. And the officer continues to shoot him until he goes down to the ground.
He put his hands into the air, being compliant, and he still got shot down like a dog.
By day five, with Ferguson businesses still smoldering, President Obama decided to weigh in.
I want to address something that's been in the news over the last couple of days, and that's the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. I know that many Americans have been deeply disturbed by the images we've seen in the heartland of our country as police have clashed with people protesting. Today, I'd like us all to take a step back and think about how we're going to be moving forward. This morning, I received a thorough update on the situation from Attorney General Eric Holder, who's been following it and been in communication with his team. I've already tasked the Department of Justice and the FBI to independently investigate the death of Michael Brown, along with local officials on the ground.
The first black president's words did little to quiet the storm. As the Hands Up, Don't Shoot rallying cry continued to spread. A new political movement was taking shape around the death of Michael Brown, and the beginnings of their argument could be heard in the cities outside of Missouri, including in Washington, D.C.
So we're right here to make a declaration that black and brown lives are worth something. Okay? We're here to make a declaration that we matter.
They argued that black lives mattered, and their Hands Up, Don't Shoot mantra was being exported to places like New York City and Denver, Colorado.
Don't shoot!
Don't shoot!
Hands up! Don't shoot!
There have also been protests across the country tonight, including in Times Square in New York City and in Washington, D.C. Finally, though, we want to take note of something going viral right now. People posting pictures with the hashtag Hands Up, Don't Shoot. Powerful images from across America. These are students at Howard University, and it's not just African Americans taking a stand. White faces, too, and white hands as well in many of these pictures.
But the problem was that the mantra was a complete lie. Michael Brown did not surrender to the officer. 6 days after Michael Brown's death, the Ferguson police chief released the name of the officer that shot him, along with a major piece of information that the key witness, Michael Brown's friend, Dorian Johnson, left out when describing the event to the press.
Ferguson police released the name of that officer, Darren Wilson, a six-year veteran, hoping to satisfy one of the key demands of the protesters. But at the same time, they released video of Michael Brown allegedly carrying out a store robbery minutes before he was shot and killed.
Police say these are pictures of Michael Brown minutes before he was killed. Security video from a convenience store. Images showing Brown allegedly stealing cigars, pushing a clerk. Police reports list Brown as a suspect in a strong-armed robbery.
Just minutes before his death, Michael Brown was allegedly involved in a strong-arm robbery of cigarette-shaped cigars called cigarillos, and the surveillance video was damning. It painted a completely different picture of the so-called gentle giant that the media had been portraying. It showed the enormous size and strength of Michael Brown, and his aggressive, even violent nature minutes before the shooting. It also provided a potential motive for why the interaction between Michael Brown and Officer Darren Wilson, a decorated officer with no history of complaints, became deadly. And perhaps most importantly, it severely damaged the credibility of the main witness, Michael Brown's friend Dorian Johnson, who left out the strong-arm robbery out of every early description of the altercation. Shortly after surveillance video was released, Dorian Johnson's lawyer was asked why his client left out this important piece of information.
On this program, your client was interviewed on this very program.
Yes.
And did not mention anything about a robbery, nothing about a QT, nothing at all. All he mentioned was a confrontation with police on Canfield Drive.
That is correct, because that had nothing to do with the incident that occurred. The officer did not know that they had robbed that plate. Not robbed, I'm sorry, let me take that back. The officer did not know that they had gone into that store and taken some of those cigarillos. He just did not know it.
But that was not true. Officer Darren Wilson did know about the robbery, as Ferguson police made clear earlier in the day.
Now, to clarify, we just spoke to Chief Jackson, who says that at some point during the encounter, the officer did see cigars in Michael Brown's hands and thought that he might be a suspect in the robbery.
You may think that most fair-minded people would find the alleged strong-arm robbery to be important information. But for the black community of Ferguson, Missouri, that didn't appear to be the case.
The police focus on the alleged robbery sparked outrage.
They want to justify them killing that boy. Homicide is homicide.
Brown's parents, through their lawyers, called it character assassination.
We believe that he strategically did that to assassinate the character of Michael Brown.
The Los Angeles Times even ran with the headline, quote, "Robbery matters little in the shooting death of Michael Brown's," experts say, end quote. The collapse of Dorian Johnson's credibility underscored the abysmal reporting on the story by the mainstream media. In their published interviews with Dorian, CNN, MSNBC, and local news never asked Dorian why Officer Wilson was only shooting at Michael Brown and not at him. If this was a random execution, why wasn't Dorian targeted as well? And perhaps more importantly, why would the officer attempt to pull a 6'5", nearly 300-pound man through the window of his vehicle, as Dorian claimed? The driver's area of Officer Wilson's vehicle was packed with equipment. There was hardly enough room for the officer himself. Pulling an enormous man into this space made absolutely no sense. No one appeared to ask Dorian that question, and if they did, they never aired it. The story Dorian weaved, knowing the pure size of Michael Brown, seemed fatally flawed, but the media ran with his version almost entirely unchecked. Dorian's credibility was further damaged when Michael Brown's autopsy showed that he was never hit in the back, as Dorian claimed. It wasn't long until conservative media further damaged the credibility of Dorian Johnson. About 2 weeks after the incident that set Ferguson ablaze, the Daily Mail reported that Dorian was arrested on a warrant for a 2011 theft. The report cited that Dorian was busted for lying to the police. With Dorian's credibility completely demolished, the mainstream media began carting out others that claimed to be eyewitnesses to continue the narrative that Michael Brown was surrendering. And when the eyewitnesses didn't match up cleanly with each other at key points, the media worked to salvage the narrative.
I just wanted you to listen to something that another witness said on this program, Tiffany Mitchell, who approached that area in her car and watched the entire thing. She never had to leave the scene for a moment, you know, as you or lose sight of it as you did. Let's listen to what Tiffany Mitchell said. Let's listen to this.
The officer gets out of his vehicle and he pursues him. As he's following him, he's shooting at him. And Michael's body jerks as if he was hit. Then he turns around and he put his hands up. And the officer continued to walk up on him and shoot him until he goes all the way down to the ground.
Michael Brady, is that essentially what you saw?
Well, like I said, I really didn't see his hands up.
I just wanted to see if you heard anything that she said. I didn't hear anything that she said that differed substantially with what you said, and I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything there.
Protests using the Hands Up, Don't Shoot mantra continued throughout the nation as more reports came out painting a clearer picture of the gentle giant as not so gentle. The New York Times reported that Michael Brown dabbled in drugs and alcohol, and that he recorded rap songs with vulgar lyrics. Some included fantasies of murder and violence. The report concluded that Michael Brown was, quote, no angel. The city of Ferguson was waiting on pins and needles as the investigation of Officer Darren Wilson came to a close. And the result of that investigation would set the city on fire. Again. More after the break.
Long-time listeners of Red Pilled America have heard Adriana and I talk about the benefits of CBD products. Initially, we were hesitant about CBD products, but once we did what we do, namely research, we found them to be a great alternative to pharmaceuticals. Our favorite CBD products are from Happy Place Oils. All of their products are grown, processed, bottled, and packaged right here in the good old US of A. We love everything they have, but these days we've been partial to their oils and gummy bears to help us reduce anxiety and get a good night's sleep. Happy Place Oils is an American company that thrives on helping people and are proud to contribute a portion of all proceeds to veterans of the United States military and their families. Right now, Red Pilled America listeners will receive 15% off when RPA is entered at checkout. Visit happyplaceoils.com, that's one word, happyplaceoils.com, and enter RPA at checkout. Orders over $75 or more receive free shipping. Wherever you go, there you are. Make it a happy place. Their products have worked wonders for me and Adriana. Try it yourself and see. Welcome back. So in the early days following the death of Michael Brown, the media ran with the narrative that the unarmed black man was executed for no reason by a white officer while surrendering. Ferguson, Missouri burned based on that narrative. When the credibility of the key witness began collapsing, the mainstream media worked to continue the narrative. Ferguson and the entire nation were waiting on pins and needles for the results of the investigation into Darren Wilson's actions. And when they were finally released, the Missouri city where it all started erupted again.
After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the 5 indictments.
As the news of no indictment reached Michael Brown's family outside of the Ferguson Police Department, Michael's stepfather had a message for the gathered crowd.
Bring his motherfucking ass! Burn his bitch down! Give me the money! Give me the money! Burn his bitch down! Burn his bitch down!
Hours after the grand jury's decision was made public, Ferguson, Missouri erupted.
Violence comes after a grand jury declined to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Crowds looted many businesses, some burned to the ground. Police made more than 29 arrests in what they call the worst night of violence since the August shooting.
Gunfire rang out in the streets. Mobs of people destroyed police cars and threw bricks at officers. And because of the gunshots in the air, the FAA rerouted planes.
On the streets of Ferguson, protests that have been largely peaceful over the last few months erupted after the grand jury's decision.
We shoot back! We shoot back!
Clouds of what appeared to be tear gas enveloped the streets. A CBS News cameraman took cover in a parking lot when gunshots rang out around him. Several businesses, including cars in this lot, fully engulfed in flames. Restaurants and stores looted. Shop owners assessing the destruction.
He's got anger all over it. You know, showcases are folded down, glasses everywhere. It's not just to take the stuff. It's more to do damage.
The mostly peaceful protests exploded into rioting worse than the initial days.
This spun out of control. What I've seen tonight is probably much worse than the worst night we ever had in August. And that's truly unfortunate.
Outside Ferguson Police Headquarters, anger boiled over. 2 police cars were set on fire as officers in riot gear and armored vehicles attempted to break up unruly crowds.
Don't shoot!
Don't shoot!
You need to stop throwing objects at the police and disperse immediately.
The rage lit up other communities as well, including New York City, where a new movement was capitalizing on the moment.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
NYPD Commissioner Bratton was splattered with fake blood on his face and suit at a Ferguson protest in Times Square. An NYPD spokesman confirmed one arrest has been made. Crowds marched from Union Square, Washington Square Park, and throughout New York City in protest of the court ruling. Important to note, it was a peaceful protest, completely silent after the verdict here, led by Q-Tip.
The protests and unrest in Ferguson forced a comment by President Obama.
First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully.
This is not the end of this, though. There is a Justice Department investigation, and there could be a civil suit.
Michael Brown supporters were holding out hope that Obama's Justice Department would charge Officer Wilson with a federal crime in the coming months. Surely a black president and his black attorney general would indict the white officer. But when Attorney General Eric Holder released the DOJ's findings in early March 2015, those hopes were also dashed.
Nearly 7 months have passed since the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. That tragic incident provoked widespread demonstrations and stirred really strong emotions from those in the Ferguson area and around our nation. It also prompted a federal investigation by the United States Department of Justice with the criminal section of our Civil Rights Division, the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Missouri, as well as the FBI, seeking to determine whether this shooting violated federal civil rights law. Now, the promise that I made when I went to Ferguson and at the time that we launched our investigation was not that we would arrive at a particular outcome, but rather that we would pursue the facts wherever they led. Our investigation has been both fair and rigorous from the start. It has proceeded independently of the local investigation that concluded in November, and it has been thorough. This morning, the Justice Department announced the conclusion of our investigation and released a comprehensive 87-page report documenting our findings and our conclusions that the facts do not support the filing of criminal charges against Officer Darren Wilson in this case. Michael Brown's death, though a tragedy, did not involve prosecutable conduct on the part of Officer Wilson. I concur with the investigative team's judgment and the determination about our inability to meet the required federal standard.
The DOJ report, along with the St. Louis grand jury documents, showed that the most reliable witnesses, along with the forensic evidence, painted a much different picture of the death of Michael Brown than that promoted by the media. The evidence made clear that Darren Wilson was justified in using lethal force. On August 9, 2014, at about 11:53 a.m. local time, Michael Brown and Dorian Johnson walked into Ferguson Market and Liquor, a local convenience store. Surveillance cameras caught Michael stealing several packages of cigarillos, a short, narrow cigar about the size of a cigarette, commonly hollowed out and filled with marijuana. Michael Brown's autopsy would later show he had marijuana in his system. When the store clerk tried stopping him, Michael used his physical size to intimidate the clerk, ultimately shoving him out of the way. Shortly after the altercation, a witness called 911 and a dispatch call went out over the Ferguson police radio announcing a stealing in progress.
Sir, we're taking a stealing in progress from 9101 West Florissant, 9101 West Florissant. Subject may be leaving the business at this time. Stand by for further.
An officer 25, not Darren Wilson, responded to the dispatch.
I'm clear. I'm right here.
A few seconds later, the dispatcher provided more detail.
25, it's going to be a black male in a white t-shirt. He's running toward Quick Trip. He took a whole box of Swisher cigars.
Black male, white t-shirt.
That's affirmative. She said he just walked out of the store.
Roughly 4 minutes later, another dispatcher gives a more detailed description of one of the suspects.
He's with another male. He's got a red Cardinals hat, white t-shirt, yellow socks, and khaki shorts. He's walking up like this.
At the time, Officer Darren Wilson was riding solo.
I was actually on my way to go get lunch.
That's Darren Wilson. Over the Ferguson police radio, Officer Wilson asks Officer 25 and Officer 22 if they need him.
21 to 25 or 22. You guys need me?
Moments later, an officer broadcasts that the suspects disappeared.
Disappeared into the woodwork.
Dispatch, can you relay? I couldn't hear him.
He thinks that they disappeared.
Sir.
Then at roughly 12.02 p.m., Officer Wilson sees two individuals.
I saw them walking in the middle of the street, single file, on the double yellow line. I had stopped in front of them and let them walk up towards me. And as they walked up, I had asked Dorian Johnson, who was the first one, to walk on the sidewalk. And his reply was, well, we're almost to our destination. And I was like, okay, well, what's wrong with the sidewalk? And then as he passed, he just kept walking, ignoring that, is when Michael Brown came next and he had exchanged some explicit words with me. He had said, what you have to say. And when I looked at him, you know, as law enforcement, we're always trained to look at people's hands. The hands are what will hurt you. And I noticed that his right hand was full of cigarillos. And it kind of all clicked then. You know, the call I'd heard, I was in the vicinity of where they were going. Cigarillos were in his hand. Dorian Johnson was wearing a black shirt. And that's when it hit me that these were the suspects from that stealing.
So Officer Wilson got back on the police radio and asked for assistance.
21, put me on Canfield with two and send me to our car.
Dorian and Michael continued walking down the middle of the road.
I then put the car in reverse and I backed up just past them and kind of blocked the street and them off.
Officer Wilson positioned his vehicle at an angle in an attempt to block them from escaping and protect the scene from oncoming traffic.
And I had gone to open the door and get out of the car. And when I did so, as I was opening the door, I said, hey, come here for a minute. And that's when he turned and said, what the f*** are you going to do about it? And slammed my door shut on me. I, again, taken aback because I've never been trapped in my car, I used my door to try and push him back and yell at him to get back. And again, he just pushed the door shut and just stares at me. He stares at me and he's like almost over top of me. It looked like he was trying to intimidate me. And as I look back at him, all of a sudden, punches start flying. He threw the first one and hit me in the left side of my face.
The St. Louis County prosecutor highlighted swelling on Officer Wilson's face.
Officer Wilson also had a medical examination, which indicated some swelling and redness to his face.
And then I don't know what or how many hit me after that. I just know there was a barrage of swinging and grabbing and pulling for about 10 seconds. I had reached out my window of my right hand to grab onto his forearm because I was going to try and move him back and get out of the car to where I'm no longer trapped. And when I felt it, I just felt the immense power that he had. I mean, the way I've described it is, it was like a five-year-old holding on to Hulk Hogan. That's just how big this man was. He was very large, very powerful man.
Michael Brown had roughly 80 pounds in Officer Wilson, and the advantage of standing outside of the car while the officer was sitting trapped in his SUV.
And then as I'm holding him, I see him coming back around with his left hand, and it's in the shape like this, and it comes in through the window and just a solid punch to the right side of my face. I mean, the next thing was, how do I survive? I didn't know if I'd be able to withstand another hit like that. I mean, you hear all the time, one punch and someone gets knocked out. And if I'm knocked out, then what happens to me? Because then I can't defend myself at all. So that was my fear, is if he hits me again, will I be conscious after that hit to still defend myself?
In the moment, Officer Wilson said his training just overrode everything. He first thought to mace Michael, but he was too close and risked incapacitating himself as well. The only thing he had left was his firearm. So while blocking his face, he withdrew his pistol.
And when I said, get back or I'm going to shoot you. And then his response, immediately, he grabbed the top of my gun. And when he grabbed it, he said, you're too much of a to shoot me. And when he did that, he had twisted it and put it down into my hip and had the barrel dug into the crease of my left hip. And while he's doing that, I can feel his hand trying to come over my hand and get inside the trigger guard and try and shoot me with my own gun. And at that point, I envisioned a bullet going into my leg.
The two struggled with the gun.
I didn't have enough strength to pull the gun up. And with just one hand, I couldn't maneuver it. So I took my left elbow and locked it into the back of my seat, and I just pushed as hard as I could like this with both my arms. And I ended up getting it to slide up my leg towards my knee. And when it got to, you know, fully outreached, I noticed it was lined up with the silhouette of his body. And that's when I pulled the trigger for the first time.
But it didn't go off.
The gun was actually being jammed by his hand on top of the firearm. I believe his finger was blocking the hammer from striking the slide. So I tried again, and again another click. And this time I'm like, this has to work, otherwise I'm going to be dead. He's going to get this gun away from me. Something's going to happen, and I'm going to be dead. So I pull a third time, and it finally goes off. It went into the door. And when it went into the door, my window had been rolled down. So the glass from the window then exploded up from the door. And when it exploded, I just remember seeing a big chunk of glass come over my hand, and I see blood on my hand. And I didn't know what it was from originally. You know, later I found out it was actually his blood because I wasn't cut.
An investigation into the shooting would later determine that the blood was Michael Brown's, as the St. Louis County prosecutor explained.
The vehicle and Officer Wilson's clothing and equipment were examined by various technicians and scientists. Mr. Brown's blood and or DNA were located on the outside of the driver's door. His blood and DNA were also found on the outside of the left rear passenger door of the police vehicle. Mr. Brown's blood or DNA was found on the inside of the driver's door, the upper left thigh of Officer Wilson's pant leg, the front collar of Officer Wilson's shirt, and on Officer Wilson's weapon. It should be noted that the three separate autopsies were conducted, one by St. Louis County Medical Examiner's Office, one by a private pathologist, and one by the Department of Defense Armed Forces Medical Examiner. The results of all three autopsies are consistent with one another in all significant respects. Mr. Brown had a gunshot graze wound of the right hand, of the right thumb. The path of that bullet is away from the tip of the hand. Soot, consistent with a close range gunshot, is present inside that wound.
The shot leaving the residue on his hand was the first time that Officer Wilson had ever discharged his weapon in a confrontation. The bullet was found lodged inside Officer Wilson's vehicle, as noted by the St. Louis prosecutor, also corroborating Wilson's account.
Additionally, a bullet fired from Officer Wilson's weapon was located inside the driver's door. The shot was fired from inside the vehicle, striking the door in a downward angle at the armrest.
But after the glass flies over, I look at him, and he kind of backs up about 6 inches to a foot. And it kind of startled both of us. We were both in shock. That's all it was shocking him to pull it, but it was also at the same time, it was shocking that this was the only option I had. After I look at him, he's kind of shocked. He gets even angrier. His aggression, his face, the intensity just increases. And he comes back in at me again. And when he comes back in, I just block my face again, and I put my gun up and try to shoot. Well, it doesn't shoot that time either.
His gun jammed.
Again, training just kicked in. I never even thought about this. Just your gun jams your racket, you get a new round in there. And when I did that, I wasn't looking at him. I was just like racket, expecting another hit, and I put my gun up and fired. And after I fired that shot, I look over. He starts to run, and I see the dust cloud behind him. And I'm like, okay, I missed. That was the round didn't hit him. Then I go to exit my car. And when I'm getting out, I use my walkie, and I say, shots fired, send more cars. And I start chasing after Michael Brown. My goal wasn't to arrest him. My goal was to maintain a visual on him. I knew I had backup on the way.
After a few feet of chase, Michael Brown stopped. Officer Wilson said he thought the young man was going to get on the ground.
But he didn't. When he stopped, he turned and faced me. And the stutter step that you sometimes see, like when people start to run and they kind of did the hop and then go, he does that. And as he does that, his right hand immediately goes into his waistband. And his left hand is a fist at his side. And he starts charging me.
As reported by the media, a grand jury witness claimed to see the same thing.
Said a witness, dang if that kid didn't start running at the cop like a football player, head down.
Again, Darren Wilson.
My initial thought was, is there a weapon in there? Is there a knife? Is there a brick? What's in there? Why is your hand going there? We're taught to let me see your hands. At that time, I gave myself another mental check. Can I shoot this guy? Can I legally? And the question I answered myself was, I have to. If I don't, he will kill me if he gets to me. He's already overpowered me once. After he's coming at me and I decide to shoot, I fired a series of shots and paused.
A local resident was chatting on a phone app, and the service recorded these shots.
You are pretty. You're so fine.
I noticed at least one of them hit him. I don't know where, but I saw his body kind of just flinch a little. And after that, I paused and I again yelled, stop, get on the ground. Giving him the opportunity to stop. And he ignored all the commands and he just kept running. And so after he kept running again, I shot another series of shots. And at least one of those hit him because I saw the flinch. And he stopped. I stopped and I said, get on the ground. Well, this time he's about 15 feet away. So I start backpedaling because he's just getting too close and he's still not stopping.
Officer Wilson said the shots didn't seem to be phasing Michael Brown.
And he was looking through me, and as he gets to that 15 feet after I fired the second round of shots, he gets to about 8 to 10 feet, and as he does that, he kind of starts to lean forward like he's going to tackle me. And 8 to 10 feet is close. I mean, if he's going to tackle me, he's going to tackle me at that point. And I looked down my barrel of my gun, and I fired, and what I saw was his head, and that's where it went.
Just going over some of your videos. How could I forget?
Within seconds of the last shot, Officer Wilson's backup arrived. According to the evidence, they were on site in less than 90 seconds from when Officer Wilson first radioed for backup. That's how quick the altercation escalated. Michael Brown was hit with at least 6 shots, all from the front, and the trajectory of the headshot indicated that his head was angled down, suggesting that he was either charging or falling. The location of the shots, all from the front, contradicted several of the key witnesses, including Dorian Johnson, who claimed Michael Brown was initially shot from behind.
And I'm looking, I'm watching the officer, he's pursuing my friend now, that he fired another shot. It struck my friend in the back.
Some of the shell casings were found within a few feet of Michael's body, which aligned with Officer Wilson's account that Michael got close to him by the final shots. Cell phone evidence immediately after the shooting showed the hands-up-don't-shoot narrative being fabricated real-time. Onlookers, who admitted they hadn't witnessed the shooting, began spreading it throughout the gathering crowd.
Dead body. Live from Ferguson. They just killed this nigga for no reason.
For no fucking reason. They started killing that boy for no motherfucking reason. She talking about some death from fireworks.
I heard nothing. No, ain't no, not this time of the day. When no fireworks
was
heard.
I'm in a bathroom in a shower. You not finna
what do? What dude do?
I'm a dead man. Do you see a gun? Do you see a knife? Do you see anything that would have caused a threat to these motherfucking police officers? They shot that boy because they wanted to shoot that boy.
Why, hold on, what? Wait a minute,
in the
just killed dude.
In the middle of the motherfucking street.
Yeah, that's fucked up, man. They said he had his hands up and everything, man.
They was trying to get at him?
I don't know. I went out here. I just heard the gunshot.
I heard the gunshot from all the way up there.
Yeah. I knew something happened. It's too early in the day. Police killed him. Yeah. Said he had his hands up and everything. They still shot him. He fell on the ground. They stood over him, shot him some more.
Several so-called witnesses would also later admit that they never actually saw the shooting.
Thousands of pages of documents made public turn up several examples of testimony with little to no credibility. Witness 22, whose testimony was at first damaging to Officer Wilson, admitted she lied when pressed by investigators, eventually telling the grand jury, quote, "I just felt like I want to be part of something. I didn't see what I told the FBI."
The information in the final DOJ report was so damning and coming from the Obama administration that it forced a high-profile, longtime proponent of the hands-up-don't-shoot hoax, a Washington Post reporter, to write an op-ed admitting that it was built on a lie.
The column is titled, "Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Was Built on a Lie." And Washington Post opinion writer Jonathan Capehart calls it the hardest piece he's ever had to write. In it, he confronts what he calls two uncomfortable truths exposed by the Justice Department's extensive investigation into last summer's shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The uncomfortable truths he identifies, first, that Michael Brown never surrendered with his hands up, and second, that Officer Darren Wilson was justified in shooting him. Jonathan Capehart joins me now. And Jonathan, one of the things you write is that what the Justice Department found made you ill. Why don't you explain?
Well, there were three things that made me ill. One was reading there in black and white that Michael Brown and Darren Wilson fought inside the officer's SUV. The second thing was reading again in black and white that DNA evidence and ballistics evidence shows that Darren Wilson and Michael Brown fought over his gun. And the third was reading the various witness statements, matching those up with DNA evidence and the ballistics evidence, and finding out with certainty that Michael Brown never had his hands up in surrender, didn't say don't shoot, and in fact was moving towards Officer Wilson. Putting all of that together is what made me ill.
Thank you. narrative that the media had weaved was a lie, but it didn't matter to a growing new movement. Immediately after the St. Louis County investigation, this movement continued to use the mantra along with another rallying cry. When the DOJ finally concluded that Michael Brown was not shot while surrendering, the movement just shifted, as one of its major media supporters admitted.
The movement moved from hands up, don't shoot, to Black Lives Matter.
And with that, the Black Lives Matter movement was born, and it was built on a lie. Knowing this, how did it spread nationally? And more importantly, what is BLM's goal? We'll answer those questions and more on the next installment of Red Pilled America.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now, our entire archive of episodes is only available to our Backstage subscribers. To subscribe, visit redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. Thanks for listening.